he decided to try and get into something totally different. He said, I want to take a break from mating psychology and I'm going to study human murder. And he said, it's all attributable to mating motivations. Even the motivations for murder, it all roads lead back to mating. It's either out of sexual jealousy, competing for mates. There's always some tributary motive. The current crop of incels are evolutionary novel, only in that they galvanize together in communities. That seems to be an evolutionary novel kind of thing.
Welcome to the Aporia podcast. This week, Bo Weingart speaks with William Costello. Remember, you can listen to this podcast on all the major platforms. If you like the show, you'll love the Aporia magazine. Find the link in the show notes, along with our Twitter and a link to the bonus questions we ask our guests.
Okay, I am Bo Weingart with Aporia Magazine, and today I am joined by William Costello, a fascinating and, dare I say, provocative young graduate student at the University of Texas, I hope I got that right, under the tutelage of one of the most eminent figures, I think we can say, of evolutionary psychology, David Buss, and William's chief area of study to date, at least, is incels, or involuntary celibates, a subgroup of celibate men whose identity is significantly shaped by their incapacity, real or imagined, to obtain sexual relationships. Do you want to add anything to that before we proceed? Do you think I got that?
No, that's quite the introduction. I know, I'll try to live up to the billing. Say some really spicy
okay,
stuff.
Okay, so I guess the first thing that I want to talk about, because I think it's such an interesting topic, and it had what Kuhn would call a paradigm-changing effect on me, is evolutionary psychology. So you're working with one of the forefathers of modern evolutionary psychology, David Buss. How did you get into evolutionary psychology?
Well, it's a funny sort of segue I had towards evolutionary psychology. I was in the final year of my English undergraduate degree, and I was doing an erotic writing module in my final year. And this led me to read a book called The Evolution of Desire by David Buss and Dr. Cindy Meston. And, you know, it just changed my viewpoint entirely. It was my first exposure to evolutionary psychology. How our sexual psychology is shaped by selection pressures in our ancestral environment, and I was hooked. So for the next 4 or 5 years, I was working in education at the time in England, and I used to commute to and from work on long drives, and every podcast, every audiobook that I kept gravitating towards was evolutionary psychology. And then in 2021, I went back to do my master's at Brunel University in London, where I studied under the supervision of Dave Schmidt, who was actually David Buss's first student. So I'm somewhat legacy there. I think I'm the only one in the world to have those two supervisors in my
collection.
It's
a good collection of supervisors.
Quite proud of that. Right, yeah. So I got my master's in Brunel in psychology, culture and evolution, and applied for my dream job here, the PhD at the University of Texas at Austin with Dr. Buss.
And you got in, which is a great... if there are...
Yes, I honestly, yeah, I didn't give myself much of a backing. I said, I'll throw a Hail Mary and make an application. But thank goodness it worked in my favor. I think Schmidt's reference must have counted heavily.
I imagine so. I mean, that's awesome. So let's ask a question about evolutionary psychology. So I don't want to get so much into what is it, I guess, or if we do, we'll get into it through other details. What was it about evolutionary psychology that changed your thinking about things? What did you just think, wow, that makes sense of something I couldn't understand or that was inexplicable before, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a kind of a way of doing psychology that looks at the mind as if our psychological mechanisms act as organs of the mind. And you must first think about what function are they trying to solve? What problems are they trying to solve? Just like your heart solves the problem of pumping blood around your body, your psychological mechanisms are trying to solve some problem in the way they motivate behavior and operate. And the best way to look and understand those psychological mechanisms, like our biological mechanisms, is to understand how they were shaped that way by natural and sexual selection. Through different selection pressures throughout our ancestral history, recurring problems that were always there for our ancestors to solve, then we would have natural selection would have equipped us with mechanisms that would look like they were designed to solve those problems. That's a kind of a way you can approach it.
Yeah, so I'll just tell a quick story about my introduction to EP, and then we can reflect on this. So I remember I was in the dentist's office, of all places, and there was a Time magazine, I believe, and it had an article on EP. It may have even been written by Buss. I don't remember who the author was. If it wasn't written by Buss, it copiously quoted Buss. But it attempted to explain why men are attracted to certain women, young women, voluptuous women, lustrous women. And I just thought, wow, you know, because like, if you don't have an evolutionary framework for this, it appears perhaps arbitrary, right? Like, I don't know what your views were, but I was under the persuasion that much of attractiveness was just culturally arbitrary. You know, one culture decides to laud this kind of woman, this culture. So that's what attracted, I don't care about the mating psychology so much, but that was just, I was like, wow, you just accept this framework and all of these things make sense all of a sudden.
Yeah, so I'm still on the mating psychology hook. That's the magic area for me. As far as I'm concerned, that's like the only game in town. Like, we're all the result of an unbroken chain of ancestors who solved the recurring problem of finding and retaining a mate for long enough to reproduce. That's kind of magic to me. And it just seems to be that one of the primary concerns on most people's minds is mating related. You know, who's mating with who, who's not mating with who, you know, who's trying to poach whose mate. That always seems to be front and center in people's minds. So, you know, I think I'm in a good business there. People are always going to be concerned about it. And, you know, we build huge billion-dollar industries around mating and cosmetic surgery to look more attractive, dating apps. Tons of literature written about mating. So yeah, it still got me on the hook, Bo. I don't know what made you fall out of love.
I'll tell you is, to quote W.B. Yeats, that is no country for old men. you get older, okay. You settle down, and then I don't know. It is interesting because I was with you. And in fact, I read The Evolution of Desire as well. That was one of the first psych books I read. And I was just... Yeah, I was enthralled with it. But yeah, over time, I don't know why I did fall out of love with the... That's not... I see the importance. I see the crucial importance. And you eloquently put this unbroken series, and it's absolutely correct. And that's the right way to think about it, right? I often would say this when I had a job back in those glory days to my students. I'd say, you have to think like you... You go, any ancestor failed to reproduce, you're not here, right? And in cells, though, yeah. That seems to be, and we'll get to those in a little bit, but that seems to be, I mean, obviously it's related to mating psychology, but there's really a dearth of evidence on incels. And perhaps that's another reason I got out of the mating psychology game, because there was just a surfeit of information there, right? I looked at it and I thought, okay, Buss, Schmidt, back, you can go backward to Simons. Like, they've already done all this cool work. Like, what is there left for me?
Yeah, and then some interesting subculture phenomenon like incels comes along, perfectly right. Timed for me in my master's dissertation. Just to add to what you said there, Bo, about the importance of mating, and I'll
no,
stop
go ahead.
Banging
Absolutely.
This drum after a while, I promise. David, when he talks about mating psychology and why he keeps focusing on it so much, in the early 1990s, after he had his big cross-cultural mating, mate preferences mm-hmm. study, he decided to try and get into something totally different. He said, I want to take a break from mating psychology and I'm going to study yes. human murder. Murder is very interesting to me. And he said, just a couple of months into reviewing the literature or doing the research, I found that it's all attributable to mating motivations. Even the motivations for murder, it all roads lead back to mating. It's either out of sexual jealousy, competing for mates. There's always some tributary motive to mating. So there's no escaping
it. Yeah, that is quite correct. I do defer and agree with that. So here's a question. So do you think evolutionary psychology, so when I got into evolutionary psychology, to date myself, I already have, I'm in the no country for old men stage of my existence. So when I got into it, it was incredibly incendiary. I remember I had professors who told me, don't say you're an evolutionary psychologist. You won't get a job. Is your sense that it's more accepted and more pervasive in the academy today than, say, even, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago?
I think, yeah, it does have that similar kind of reputation, and undeservedly so, mm-hmm. in my opinion. It's remarkable. A lot of the critique that gets, or what passes for critique that gets thrown evolutionary psychology's way, it criticizes us for making just-so right. stories. Which is another way of saying
hypothesis,
making a hypothesis and testing. Yes. It. Yeah, but remarkably, a lot of the criticism is just so stories. They're just saying things right. about evolutionary psychology. Not really.
Right, so like I thought this. I'm sorry, I'm interjecting, but just briefly. You know, Stephen Jay Gould, who was one of the most, I will say, eloquent and brilliant, but tendentious critics of evolutionary psychology. You know, he came up with these ideas like spandrels, and it's like, yeah, but a spandrel is also just a quote-unquote just-so story. I mean, that's all we're stuck in with science is just-so stories or hypotheses, and then we look for data.
Yeah, and they say it's unfalsifiable. I mean, I even had an ethics professor at the beginning of the year in a kind of an ethics workshop we had to do for our PhD, and he said, let's all try and apply the ethical topics to our own subfield. And I mentioned evolutionary psychology, and he said, oh, but isn't ethics, you don't really have to worry about the ethics there because you just say things about and make things up after the fact. I was like, on the contrary, we can actually make predictions using evolutionary theory a priori ahead of time, and they're very solid and actually more resistant to the replication crisis than a lot of social psychology. So, but it was remarkable that someone at that level would feel kind of comfortable saying that to a graduate student as well. I thought that was a hell of a thing to say to a graduate student about their field that they're obviously passionate about. But I'm happy to go to the mat fighting for EP, to be honest. I really love the field, so I'll be a hardcore. And yeah, in terms of maybe it might make it harder for me to get jobs different places, but I only want to work somewhere that is somewhere I want to work. I want to work with, you know, colleagues who are EP friendly, evolutionary psychology friendly, and, you know, open-minded to doing that work.
Very sagacious, I would say. That is the right way to pick a job, because you pick a job for the wrong reasons and you're stuck there. And that's painful. So here, do we think, though, that so some of the criticisms the field gets, I think we can dismiss really the just-so story, because obviously it's just a hypothesis. I mean, it's not a particularly trenchant criticism. There is, I guess, and I actually had this experience myself. I don't know if you did, but there's something deflating about evolutionary psychology. I know this is a rather perhaps aesthetic concern, but I think this is one reason ethics professors might recoil from it and find it repugnant, because it seems, and this is, I think, wrong to at least to a degree, but it does seem to deflate humans, right? It seems to suggest that most of what they do is somehow selfish. And as you said earlier, about mating. Of course, Freud would be smiling and say, yeah, it's all about sex. But a lot of people find that somewhat, unseemly, or like the human is this vastly more sophisticated thing. Did you have any of those experiences? And do you think any of those criticisms are, you know, legitimate?
I suppose you could look at it that way. And one way it's described, Richard Dawkins describes humans as vehicles for their genes. So that kind
Yes.
of maybe does kind of strip you of your
Yes.
humanity. And you know, the way that evolutionary psychology looks at the mind with massive modularity of we're just a collection of all these problem-solving mechanisms, that there's no real self there. There's no real homunculus self inside steering all your psychological mechanisms. I suppose you could look at that as stripping of humanity to some degree, but you know, we're an incredibly special ape. One of my favorite evolutionary psychology books is by Steve Stewart Williams, who wrote The Ape That Understood the Universe. And he talks about humans as primarily as the cultural animal, and that's our main innovation is that allows us to kind of colonize every ecological niche around the world is this ability to transmit culture and knowledge through time. So there's a lot about like evolutionary psychology that, you know, the way it interacts with culture. I think a big pervasive myth about evolutionary psychology is that it is opposed to culture, that there's cultural learning or there's evolved instincts. And we're evolved to learn from culture, and we're evolved to respond to culture and spread it. Culture is a biological output. So I don't think that those two are, you know, as opposed as is suggested. So yeah, I kind of, the more I think about humans as a reluctant to use the word pinnacle of evolution because it's not, I don't really see it that way, but kind of, you know, in our evolutionary history, this moment that we're at now where we can contemplate the workings of the cosmos, that's kind of incredible. You know, when you look at all the other biological kind of mammals that were our closest cousins, even, you know, it's amazing what humans can
So
do.
I think that's an eloquent and well, I guess, articulated point. Two, and maybe I already forgot, maybe one already drifted away into the ether, one of these ideas. So maybe I'll just go with the other. Which is the on the ethical side. So I think they're what people are disconcerted by, and what disconcerted me, so I can sympathize with this, is that you and I, as evolutionary psychologists, would look at a behavior, say somebody helping somebody across the road, and we would ask, how did that help this person's inclusive fitness, or their and indeed their ancestors' inclusive fitness, right? And so there seems to be something, and in my experience with talking with people about evolutionary psychology, they've found that troubling, that we don't take be in some sense we apply a what the literary types would call a hermeneutics of suspicion. Like, we think there's some other motivation underneath it. You know what I mean? So, like, you made the point about mating. So, like, yeah, people write books and they say they just love to write poetry and they love to read poetry, but I'm sure William Costello would tell me that there's some mating motive there. One, would you tell me that? And two, can you see then why, I guess, like in the humanities, they seem afraid of this? And you remember Edward Wilson's book, Consilience, which essentially argued everything was biology. People were outraged by that book.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Yeah, this resistance to kind of see ourselves as the human animal. And mating is a good example of this, actually. So I use the term mating market quite liberally online and sometimes get in trouble if someone from the mainstream audience who doesn't know that that's common parlance in the literature, mating market, mating that make value, all these terms. And they really bristle at this term mating market. They say, oh, that's such an ugly term. You know, it's not a market. And I say, okay, well, you compete to be chosen, to be selected. Certain traits are valued more than others. You know, what those traits are, you can debate back and forth, sure. But it seems like a market to me, and it behaves like a market. But I wonder, those people who criticize the term, how do they make their mating decisions? Just completely arbitrarily? Just like, oh, it's not a market. I don't have any, you know, rules at which I go by. It just happens. It's like, it's
So,
insane to me
William, so it's
to
kind of like
resist the
this.
term.
You know how you, So say you're with your wife and you're thinking, you know, if Brad Pitt had been a little younger and had went for my wife, she obviously would have chosen Brad Pitt over me. That's sort of the discomfiting thought of the main market, because it seems to, and actually, as we would both know from EP, like there, we actually evolved a tendency to dislike the idea that our relationships are utilitarian. That is to say, we want to think that our partners are committed to us almost irrationally, right?
Yeah, and we're also evolved to be kind of, to have our motivations hidden from ourselves often. So, you know, to assign like a teleology way deeper than is actually the case to what happens. You know, so often you hear about your soulmate, or you meet your soulmate. And I remember having a very frank conversation with my father when I was in my late teens. And I said, do you believe that my mother was the one for you, or did you? And they've had a great relationship. No, never any major problems outside of they managed to raise me. So that was a tough enough challenge. But I asked him, I said, do you believe that it was just the one and only? And what would have happened if you never met her? And he just kind of said, nah, there probably would have been others. There probably would have been others for her. I'm sure we would have been fine. And it kind of, on one level, you could say, oh, my God, that strips all the magic away from my parents' relationship. But it doesn't. You know, it's like it's patently obvious to me. It doesn't really strip the magic away. And it's really weird with incels are a good example of this. So, number one, people question the importance of mating when they talk about incels. They often just say, why do they care so much? Why don't they just simply not care, focus on other things? So even the great Doug Kenrick, who's a great evolutionary psychologist, and he's written a book about the fundamental human motivations, of which he describes mating as one. He was really pleased. He wrote a response article to our first incel paper. He wrote a Psychology Today blog about it. And he's kind of I was thrilled with this, but I actually didn't really agree with his thesis of the piece. He kind of just questioned, isn't there more to life than mating? And here's seven things you could do outside of just focusing on mating. You could help your friends get a mate. You could all these things. And I was thinking, oh, my God, I don't know how comforting that would be to many incels. So, you know, just telling them, don't worry about this problem you're worried about. That seems strange to me.
This reminds me. Before, so I'll get to the incel part and the Kenrick point, but it reminds me there was this Onion article back when the Onion was funny still, and I'm going to butcher it, but it was something like, man finds soulmate in his own neighborhood. And then they have like an interview and he's like, I can't believe she lived in my own neighborhood. What are the odds?
Yeah, what are the odds?
Yes, I agree with you, because I went through this purgatory and I've come out the other side and realized you can still have this enchanted world, and understanding all of the evolutionary and the ultimate motivations, it doesn't necessarily sort of vitiate that. But I do think a lot of people, just my friends still, and even people I know who are somewhat sympathetic, anytime we're in a conversation and I start digging for the evolutionary motivation, they almost roll their eyes and they find it a bit troubling. Now, the Kenrick part to the incels. So I do want to ask this before we get into the incels. It's an utterly fascinating topic, and I hope maybe I can push back against some things you said, only in a cordial way, of course, just to have a fun debate here. But is there anything about the definition of incel we need to know that's like interesting? Like, we know they're involuntary celibates, okay, but is there something interesting we should know about that before getting into that?
Yeah, I think there is. So we have a deep evolutionary history of incels, actually. There's always been a greater variability of reproductive success among men. We have far more female ancestors than we have male. Many, many more men die before reproducing than do women. So you've always had incels throughout our evolutionary past. A lot of men who die before reproducing or maybe can't find a mate at all. And this was the case, and things got really, really bad. Specifically around about 8,000 years ago, there was a really bad time for incels. And what happened there was that with the advent of agriculture, it allowed the most high status man in a culture to accumulate wealth to such a degree that it was more advantageous for a woman in that society to be the second wife or third wife of the high status man than a lower status man. So it led to the proliferation of many, many incels. So that's one thing to really know that we do. It's not the current crop of incels are evolutionary novel only in that they galvanize together in communities. That seems to be an evolutionary novel kind of thing. There was throughout history a lot of cultural institutions that could have dealt with your surplus population of unpartnered young men, like war. You might send your young men off to war, because a surplus population of unpartnered young men is very destabilizing for a society. In evolutionary psychology, we call this young male syndrome. And it just means that due to risk-taking and status striving, young men without a mate are typically really, really dangerous. And that's been the case cross-historically, cross-culturally. So you'd need to develop cultural institutions to kind of deal with this surplus population, one of which is the cultural evolution of monogamy. The main advantage to monogamy was that you had a more egalitarian distribution of mates. And I know a lot of listeners might really bristle yes. when they hear me talk about the distribution of mates. So whatever about mating market, the distribution of mates as a resource, that's going to really get me in trouble. But I did promise you
I want to get to that point. So, but let me push on something, or at least tease out finer detail here. So you say we've had incels in the sense that we've had men who were involuntarily celibate. That is, they wanted to have sex, but they couldn't. But we could conceptualize incels in two different ways, right? One way would just be anybody who's an involuntary celibate, in which case there would be women who are incels as well, etc. And there have always been incels. Another way to conceptualize them, and I think this is one that you've used in your articles, is they also derive a sense of identity from that. So we could imagine 8,000 years ago, you talk about this particularly dire period of time for many men. And it is true. Like, people need to think about, like, you're talking possibly 20, 30, 40% of the men who have no viable reproductive prospects. So these people are essentially involuntary celibates. Maybe they sneak something in every now and then, but they don't have anything consistent. But it's not clear, obviously we don't have writing from back then, that their identity was importantly shaped by that. That is, that they identified as this aggrieved, victimized group of people. So do you see what I'm saying? Do you think this distinction is important? And I'll say why. I think it's important because I find incel version two, that is to say the aggrieved version, much more pernicious than just, I mean, it's quite unfortunate that there are incels at all, obviously, but I think the ones who identify with their victimhood are the ones who are problematic.
Yeah, so you make a very good point about the distinction between incels throughout our evolutionary history. They would have made it a part of their identity only insofar as they were trying to escape that predicament. They were probably out trying right. to seek mates, not hunkering down into victimhood, whereas the current crop of incels, they're actually not out trying to seek mates at all. So that's very almost puzzling. But an unintended positive consequence, and I know the victimhood is really bad, and there's lots of elements of incel identity that is really harmful, but it might actually be buffering against this young male syndrome of young men out status striving and mm-hmm. causing trouble in an attempt to get mates. And, you know, there's also an element of evolutionary mismatch going on here, Bo, because you mentioned there how disturbing it would be ancestrally for a man to kind of be looking at an evolutionary zero with his reproductive prospects. And if you think about it now, so evolutionary mismatch for your listeners is the idea that our current environment differs meaningfully from the environment in response to which our psychology evolved. So if we think about that in terms of incels and mating, you could think that throughout most of our ancestral history, you might have encountered maybe a couple of dozen potential mates in your lifetime. So persistent rejection would have been perceived as catastrophic. So that's the psychology we're strapped with still in the current environment, but you're encountering hundreds of thousands of mates a day on Tinder, but the rejection still hurts the same. So, and you, it might compound things. So in our ancestral environment, you would have had to receive maybe three or four rejections, and all of a sudden your reputation is shot, all the girls in the community don't want you, and you're out. So that maybe is making the pain a bit more for modern incels, and they're reluctant to compete in the anxiety-inducing mating market. But yeah, there's all sorts of elements, positive and negative, of the current incel identity that are very interesting and make the incel identity more attractive for young men than actually competing in what they see as an anxiety-inducing mating.
So you make a good point here, which is a point that I've thought about since I was, I don't know, 12 or 13, which is, why does it hurt so bad to get rejected, right? So there's this it's, I mean, it's one of the worst, you know, by the time I got into my 20s, I was much, I was like, whatever. But as a youngster, it was definitely an incredibly painful experience. And also, that means equally, it was incredibly anxiety-inducing to think about asking somebody out. And your point is, well, look, if you take our ancestral environment, that is the environment in which we evolved for thousands of, hundreds of thousands of years, getting rejected a couple of times might have blown your reputation to smithereens in your group, right? So it actually was a severe, like, social mistake to do that. And so what you're saying now is like, okay, it feels the same to us, though, in the same way that maybe watching a horror movie is terrifying, even though nobody's going to kill us from the horror movie. So what happens then is that men, we might think to ourselves, well, just, you know, get on Tinder, ask 200 people out. You'll get rejected 198 times, but two times you might get a date. But we're ignoring.
Yes, error management.
Right, but we're ignoring, of course, the massive psychological toll that would take on any normal human being. So what happens instead is, after a protracted period of rejection, these people just retreat from the marketplace altogether. And that leads to this weird phenomenon. And I actually was not aware of this until one of my students showed me these chat sites before. I think they mostly got taken down. You probably know more about that than I do, and we can talk about that. But these groups of people who would obsess over their own incompetence, their ugliness, and their inability to get a date. And it was like a way of, I don't know, like, it was really weird to me, the psychological cause of this behavior. So what do you think, why do you think people would sort of like bathe warmly in their own abject humiliation? Because that's what they do. They almost compete to mortify themselves more than the next person.
Yeah, so there's a lot going on there, but there are unique elements of incel identity that make it actually attractive. So when I first started studying this topic, I thought the same as you. How could anyone come to define themselves around this aspect? Why would they choose to constantly reinforce this idea? But so the first thing that's going on there is something called self-verification theory, which was developed by a professor at UT who taught me this year, actually, Professor Bill Swan. And he recently wrote a paper analyzing incels through this lens. Self-verification theory suggests that humans have an inclination to surround ourselves with others who see themselves in the same way. So whether you see a cat or a lion in the mirror, you want to surround yourself with people who see the same thing and don't tell you, oh, you're actually great. And that very much describes incels. The worst thing you can say to an incel is, you're not so bad. You could develop yourself and you could go out and get a girlfriend.
Okay.
They don't want to hear that. They want to hear, Yes, you're as
May
bad
I
as
interject
you say you are.
right there before allowing you, of course, to proceed,
Sure.
just because I want to push on the self-verification theory, because to an evolutionary psychologist, self-verification theory could be puzzling. Because if you say to me, like, I think that I'm a hideous person, but let's say that three girls think that I'm awesome, why should I want to discard what they're saying and reject it and seek out people who also think I'm a terrible, low talent, nothing? Like, what would be the adaptive advantage to that?
So you have some sort of coalitional psychology being engaged there of incels. Actually, those are their friendship networks, and they to engage with the mating market would actually be to put that at risk, because they actually might kick them
yes.
out of the forums. So there's some of that going on. But in terms of just self-verification theory more generally, and I did have this discussion with my professor about what is the function of, you know, this accurate self-view. But if you just think about your sense of self and what you think others' sense of that self is, it needs to be useful in the world. So if it's very unsettling if people are describing you in a way that you don't feel accurate. And an example of that might be, imagine you're out on a night out in a bar somewhere, Bo, and I'm with you and we're friends. And then I start drinking a little bit too much and I start telling all the toughest guys in the bar, Bo would kick your ass. He is absolutely, you know, this guy, he would... He's tough. He's tougher than you, and start picking fights on your behalf. It's a positive thing, but you know it's inaccurate, and it's getting you in trouble. It positions you in the hierarchy in a place that you're not comfortable falling from. And that's what I think incels don't like. They prefer the accurate self-assessment rather than it just feels more authentic to them, and therefore more useful to navigate the world with.
That's a really good point, because... So the fighting one's a very direct and immediate example. You know, obviously that would be incredibly costly, but I can even think of another one. So suppose that we're out, we're working for some politician and you're saying, Bo is the most eloquent writer I've ever encountered. And let's say I think I'm a terrible writer, and actually I am, let's say. And you're like, he's just this great writer. He's a brilliant orator. And they like give me a job and I've freaking humiliate myself. That is also very costly. So yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. So it's actually the case that although it might be advantageous in the moment for people to believe that you're better than you are, in the long run, it might actually be quite deleterious. And another point you made there, which is an interesting one, is that at some point, okay, so if these people go back, once they get in with this coalition and that's their identity, if they were to go back on the mating market and maybe even have moderate success, they would probably be jettisoned from their community. Is that right? Is that the incel like rule?
Yeah, that seems to be a pervasive kind of behavior among incels, because incels largely believe in what's called the black pill. And black pill is a derivative of the red pill from the movie The Matrix, which describes seeing the world as it really is compared to the blissful ignorance of the blue pill. So the black pill for incels is a particularly bleak truth to swallow. The belief that there's nothing that could ever be done to improve their romantic prospects and they should lay down and rot and there's no hope. It was over from the beginning. It's all very dismal. And, you know, that's quite appealing, because a little bit of hope is more dangerous to incels, because it means they have to try and engage in the mating market and overcome that anxiety, face the rejection. You know, with incel identity comes your coalitional psychology of your friends. You've got a fun trolling language of internet culture to kind of feel a part of. You've got a common enemy. You've got a black and white way to view the world. You've got an excuse to not put yourself out there, not develop yourself. What else have you got? You've got tons. A victimhood identity, which is very, very popular now, especially online, where incels accumulate more than primarily. So when you trade that against an evolutionist or just someone with my male typical psychology might think, yes, I know the anxiety of the mating market. Yes, I know it hurts to be rejected, but God damn it, it's worth it on the other side, I promise you. But it's not obvious to me that that is obvious to incels. They might be just satisfied with online worlds, pornography, you know, the dating market. And, you know, I say that as someone, to be romantically successful, you have to go through a lot of rejection and be willing to do that. But I've come to kind of learn that for a lot of men, there just isn't enough green light there to go for. It's all red. It's all rejection or perceived this way. And it's just not worth it to go through it for them. So it's not obvious to me that the answer for every incel is to re-engage with the mating market. That might be anxiety inducing. It might be pretty harmful for the girls they encounter, things like that. But yeah, it's a weird one that we see so much trade-off. So there's an evolutionary psychologist called Mira Lindner, and she has a really, really brilliant new paper out analyzing incels from an evolutionary lens. And, you know, it's super. It explains the young male syndrome idea completely, very, very well done. But there's one area of it that I really disagree with her on. She characterizes incels as coalitional bargaining for sexual access. And I see that incels might have done this throughout our ancestral history. A group of men team up together, maybe try and kill the Chad alpha at the top and just stand a chance, something like this. But in the modern incarnation of incels are distinct in that they do not bargain for sexual access. In fact, they actually try and hold each other back and themselves. It doesn't appear obvious to me that they want to bargain for sexual access at all. They seem to be having coalitional psychology engaged to bargain for maybe better social treatment or proof of victimization. So incels might collectively engage in misogyny to incur some backlash, and there it's proof that society hates them. See, I was right all along. So yeah, so it's interesting. I would say they're coalitional bargaining, but just not for sexual access, which makes them so peculiar.
Yeah, so that a lot of fascinating things there. But you lay out the case that in fact you can see at first blush it appears the ideology appears like hideously misaligned with human psychology. Like, why would you ever find that appealing? But what you're saying is there are a lot of things that are intuitively appealing about this, especially for someone whose prospects on the mating market, although perhaps not dismal, are not exactly rosy, right? So like, it's easy to dismiss this ideology when you have a pretty good time on the mating market. So before getting to that, because I want to dig into that, let's talk about the socially enforced monogamy, because I think this is both controversial but really important to think about. So the point you've been making is the mating pool, the mating system is a market, and that means there's supply and there's demand. And socially enforced monogamy, which we tend to take for granted, is actually literally a way of redistributing female resources. That is what it's doing, right? Because it's essentially saying, it's essentially a tax on highly successful men. It's saying you cannot actually legally have three marital partners, right? Or even two marital partners. Of course, you and I both know, you know, like, it's highly unlikely that, let's say, Ben Affleck hasn't had a lot of sexual partners, including when he was in relationships. I don't know this for sure. I don't read People or whatever the gossip are, but it's quite likely that most successful men are getting around this. Nevertheless, legally, we've essentially redistributed sexual resources. For a lot of people, that is, I don't know, like a crude way of thinking about it or talking about it. But would you agree that that's essentially what's happening? And in fact, it's really no different from redistributing any other coveted resource.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is. And I remember Jordan Peterson got in a lot of trouble for using the term socially enforced monogamy, which is also pretty common in the literature. I mean, he has a penchant for using the most controversial phrasage. However he does it, he has a knack for that. But, you know, what he's describing is absolutely the case. We do have socially enforced monogamy, or have had for many decades. you know, it is absolutely the norm that someone will only take one mate at a time, at least. You know, polyamory and stuff like that is growing, but it's still a minority. It's not a strong cultural norm. And yeah, it is one of the positives of it, that it creates less disenfranchised young men who are engaging in this young male syndrome. And it just, the way it evolved is that the cultures that began to practice monogamy flourished, whereby those that didn't. You know, if you have monogamy as your strong cultural norm, it freed up all these other young men from competing aggressively for mates and killing each other in the process, towards economic output for their culture. And those cultures thrived. And now we have, so you can also look at it that 93% of human societies, or 83%, sorry, have been preferentially polygynous. So that has actually been the norm for most of our ancestral environment. But very few men in those societies had enough resources to attract more than one mate. But that was still the norm. So you could see the modern mating market as kind of a more of a gish-gallop system, whereby it's both polygynous and polyandrous. So one man, multiple female partners, one woman, multiple male partners. But the kind of standard deviation of success, sex partners among men is really, really high, whereas it's more equal among women. Most women get a chance, whereas now some men do really, really well, and some men are kind of left out.
Yeah, so this is interesting because it raises, and I know this is debated in the literature still, and I can't say that I've followed the debate that closely recently, but a lot of people have raised the question, what led to monogamy? Who was driving that decision? Now, you said it's essentially cultural selection. That is to say, cultural units that were monogamous out-competed those that weren't. But there's a debate within that. Is it better for women or is it better for men, right? And so you look at the most provocative, well, Kanazawa, I think he generally puts things simply and provocatively, right? And his argument was, look, like, this is driven by men, and actually women would prefer to, and if they are allowed the choice, they engage in polygyny because it's better to be Bill Gates's, say, fourth wife and to reap the benefits of that than to be some like average person's only wife. Do you have a view on that?
And yeah.
Because I'll just put, like, from the work of Geary and others have argued, I think persuasively, that polygyny is also like pretty ruinous to women. It creates a lot of female competition and I think it almost like works better for both sexes in the sweet spot societies where resources are distributed evenly enough that being married to that average Joe is actually worth it.
Yes, I think that's the key. If you create an environment with such mm-hmm. inequality, then it becomes more advantageous for the woman to be the second wife of the top guy. And you even see this in like female competitive nature. In areas of high income inequality, women behave more promiscuously, take more sexy selfies, have more short-term mating, because that's the preferred male strategy. Where you create a minority of men that are worth competing for, women will compete more aggressively. And you're right to point out that it's actually not that this polygynous setup is not actually a picnic for anybody. So I'll tell you a story that Helen Fisher, I heard her say on a podcast. She was walking, she's an anthropologist, and she was walking with, I think, a member of the Himba tribe. I might be wrong on that. But he was the high status man in this tribe, and he currently had three wives. And he was walking along with Helen Fisher, and she asked him, in an ideal world, how many wives would you want? And, you know, we've heard about Genghis Khan having thousands of concubines and men wanting so many partners. And he already had three wives, this guy. And he just stopped, leaned into her and said, none. He said, in an ideal world, I would have none, because they're always fighting, poisoning each other's kids, things like that. So it just kind of shows you that this It occurs in areas of massive inequality, maybe harsher environments, and where it becomes more advantageous. Like, how bad do things have to get at the bottom that you'd rather be second place to a top
status?
And you even see this, actually. It's interesting with incel research. You see incel activity crop up more in geographic areas of high income inequality, where there's, you know, fewer high status men to compete for. You also find that with in areas of low gender pay gaps, where women don't have to settle for a man out of economic necessity, and then male biased sex ratios, where there's just fewer single women in the first place. So it's amazing that you can use mating ecology, like the information about the local mating ecology, and predict where you'll find incels.
So that's within even, say, the United States, or even within a state?
But that's just within the United States. I think they went state level as well.
Yeah, even beyond that, yes. So here's the thing that I found fascinating, I'm sure it will surprise nobody that I like to be provocative from time to time. It's fun to start debates. And so I'd often ask my progressive friends why they're opposed to sexual redistribution, but fervidly advocate economic redistribution. And I think this is an interesting thing, because we're talking about socially enforced monogamy. And of course, Peterson got in a lot of trouble for that. But progressives advocate for economic redistribution. Indeed, they think it's like one of the great goods of the government is that it can redistribute economic resources. For some reason, when you suggest that maybe you should redistribute sexual resources a little bit more, they find that appalling. I don't know if you've encountered that or what your thoughts are on that, because it does seem weird that progressives, in fact, now they might be advocating ideologies such as polyamory that are exacerbating these problems.
Yeah, absolutely. And some people suggest that polyamory could be a solution to the incel problem, but I just think it would create more
solution
more couples
argument?
That would reject.
I'm sorry, I talked over you, but what's the solution argument?
So the argument is that incels could perhaps placate themselves by being the second husband of a woman. And they're just not considering the data that I mentioned earlier. There's 83% of human societies have been preferentially polygynous, meaning one man, multiple wives. How many do you think have been preferentially polyandrous?
Virtually none.
Virtually none. I think it's like 0.3%. And they occur in like regions of Nepal with really, really harsh environments. And the idea there is that for a family, if three brothers in the family had to each go out and form a family of their own and have land of their own, there wasn't enough land to go around. So brothers would share one wife and on the one plot of land. So it occurs predictably in these ways, but at nowhere near the rates of polygyny. Women don't seem to want to have multiple.
Yeah, adults. So I think the thing with monogamy is, and this is becoming clearer, I think, and it is like a fundamental tension with what you might call like full-blown liberalism, is people are realizing, you know, people made these arguments probably in the 50s and 60s especially, but I hear these arguments more often now, that monogamy is like this weird form of ownership. And it seems people like are starting to think it seems illiberal. Like, okay, you own a person's reproductive organs and you can tell them they can't use them in any other way. And in a sense, that is what it is, right? It's a contract between two people that we are hereby relinquishing the use of this. And the government has said, if you enter into this contract that's financially beneficial for you, and that's like this socially endorsed and indeed, well, at one time revered institution, you can't get outside of it. You cannot do what you want to do, even if you both want to do it. So, monogamy, do you think, and you actually had a poster I read that you presented on how modern society might, some of these trends are exacerbating this, or perhaps actually the better way to say this, they're accelerating a move toward effective polygyny again, right? Do you think that Well, you can comment on that. And then do you think the sense that, oh, this is like a coercive institution and people are becoming aware of it as coercive is also contributing to this move perhaps toward polyamory, which really means basically more polygyny?
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier that this current time in human mating is a very, very evolutionary novel time. But the most evolutionary novel part, apart from online dating, which is an incredibly novel feature of the modern mating market, but is just the extent to which men and women don't need to rely on each other as role mates anymore. So throughout our ancestral history, you needed to rely on each other for, you know, one hypothesis of monogamy is the bodyguard hypothesis, that women, you know, benefited a lot from attaching themselves to one man to defend from dangerous other men. You've kind of farmed that work out to the state anymore. And, you know, it's not very obvious that the patriarch of the house is protecting physically his wife and their offspring. You know, it's kind of much more farmed out to the state. You also have resources where women are beginning to outpace men in education and in the workplace. Up until in many cities in America, up until the age of 29, women actually out-earn men. So you've got these two features that made men really attractive as a monogamous mate that are no longer really pushing the same buttons. So women's response to that might be to just increase their singlehood or to engage in more short-term mating. You know, it's not obvious to me that women are happy to settle with men they don't want to. Women typically have a hypergamous mating strategy, which is to mate with a man that's an equal or higher status than themselves. And if there are fewer of those men around, women are going to either compete aggressively for those men at the top or just remain single. Or when they mate down, it doesn't appear obvious that they're very happy about it because it leads to all sorts of problems, increased infidelity on both partners' parts, increased erectile dysfunction, anxiety, insomnia, depression medication among mateships where the woman is mating down, and most troublingly still, huge data to support that it's a massive risk factor for intimate partner violence. And here's another spicy thing for me to say, just while I'm on a roll, you know, people will hear that and say, oh, so women shouldn't ever earn more than their male partner. It's like, I don't think that's realistic or even desirable. You know, in the modern economic workplace, women in a brain-based economy, women are a great asset. So that's not really realistic and it's not desirable to kind of hold the brakes on women like that. But you do need to think about what is happening in response to that. How is male evolved psychology responding to that, feeling threatened, whatever it may be, and inflicting costs that way? Because in order to retain your mate, you have two strategies of mate retention. You can either benefit provision. If you have enough benefit to provide, you can make it so attractive to your partner to be with you that they don't want to leave you. But if you don't have much benefit to provide, you choose the cost infliction mate retention strategy. And the way that works is you try to lower your partner's self-esteem and in some cases even physically beat them up. And you say things like, oh, who would have you except me? So that the partner doesn't calibrate their mate value and leave you. So it's really dark aspects of human psychology. And you mentioned earlier about the resistance towards evolutionary psychology. But using it in this way to understand human nature, in order to override that human nature or to buffer ourselves against it, that's a really important mission. And, you know, that's one aspect of human psychology. We do have a great executive function of being able to override some of these evolved psychology, of some of this evolved psychology. But you first need to understand it. And that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah. So one of the things that incels will say, because I've read some of their chats, again, I don't know. I think they were actually on Reddit back when I was reading them, perhaps before they cracked down. But they're not, I mean, sometimes they make reasonably sophisticated criticisms of feminism, but most of the time it's this very, you know, grotesque, like caricatured version of feminism, which they rail against. But let's take, so I guess two things. One, do you think that I find their chat rooms, while sympathizing with the plight, I find the chat rooms really disconcerting, and I think it's quite pernicious this way that they've settled on attempting to solve this real problem by reveling in their own victimization, because that leads to, and in fact, you have research on like their sense of victimization, and one thing that you get, well, you get a number of things with that, right? But you get a lack of empathy, for example. And now Elliot Rodger, the so-called virgin killer, would be a very extreme example of this. But I would say some of the online discourse was pretty similar to his. That doesn't mean that it was actually real, because as you put it, a lot of it's performative. But if you watch Rodger's videos, he, in his worldview, he's the victim, right? Like, he's given these women all of these chances and they still won't choose him. And now he is going out for vengeance. And who's ever been more entitled to vengeance than Elliot Rodger, right? Like, that's the sick thoughts you get from him. So I find that really disconcerting. And perhaps you can talk about that. But also, I do think this raises some questions and some legitimate criticisms of feminism and some of these things that are happening, at least the view that it's an unalloyed good and that there aren't trade-offs.
Yeah, there's certainly, I agree with you with the lack of empathy from incels, because when you see yourself as a victim, it does lead to this lack of empathy. And the way that might manifest for incels is, well, nobody cares about my pain, why should I care about yours? And they also commit a lot of failures of cross-sex mind reading when trying to empathize with how things might be difficult on the mating market for women as well. Because what they do is they use male typical psychology and act as if women should have similar psychology. So I'll give you an example. I'm often asked, are there fem cells? Are there female incels? And if not, why not? And originally, I used to say the typical incel answer, actually, and say, well, not really, because most women could, if they wanted to, they could go out and get sex or a relationship if they wanted to. They just might have to lower their standards, but they could find some. It might not be exactly what they wanted, but they could definitely get some, whereas incels can often get none, and that's worse. And for incels, and perhaps men in general, some is always better than none, right, in terms of sex. I always say sex is like pizza for men. There's good pizza and there's pizza. There's no bad pizza. But for women, there really is bad pizza, right? Incels and men in general maybe really underestimate how much women don't want to have sex with men they don't want to have sex with. It's really cost-inflicting for them. So if you think ancestrally as well, the risk they were taking of carrying offspring with genes they didn't want, a lot of it, they would rather not. So incels use their male typical psychology and say, well, they're privileged because they could get some rather than none. And it's not really the case, because if it's not any of what you want, then it actually might be very cost inflicting to you, then it's actually not a net good to be able to get some rather than none. So that is a very clear example of that lack of empathy, not taking sex differences into account, not seeing it through their lens. But to speak to your second point, I think that's the real cultural kind of malaise that we're seeing now. Every second week, I see an article about women maybe freezing their eggs or they're involuntarily childless. There's a couple of statistics that I learned about in a documentary called Birth Gap about the fertility crisis and the population collapse by Stephen Shaw. And he talks about how, I think it was upwards of 80% of childless women are involuntarily so. And I found that an incredible statistic. He talks about how if a woman is childless at the age of 30, she has a 50-50 chance of whether she's actually going to go on and have a child thereafter. So this kind of evolutionary novel prioritizing career first and then try and wrap up all your mating goals and reproductive goals in a narrow little window for women is not seeming to work out that well. And, you know, That's a conversation I don't think we're having very well at the moment. There are a couple of people who are banging that drum and maybe starting to create awareness about it. But the main kind of narrative is women, you don't need no man anymore. Go, you can travel more if you don't have a child, and this kind of lionizing mm-hmm. of this childless life. And it's not as if I can see a lot of the feedback, people saying, oh, two straight white men talking about what women should do in their 30s. And this is not just me and Bo saying this is bad for the world, fertility decline, population collapse. That is a huge problem. But make no mistake, this is by women's mm-hmm. own mm-hmm. desires. They're having fewer children than they want. That's bad. So that's even if you take aside the, you know, the global macro issue, if you just look at women's desires, that it's not
so
good.
So let me put on my feminist cap just for a second so I can earn some ingratiating points with them before criticizing them. So I think your point about the incels misperceiving femcels is an important one. And it's something I often think about with, like, say, Me Too and these women who would complain about getting ogled. And I would some of my more provocative conservative male friends would say, like, yeah, who the fuck cares? That's great. Like, I would rather people like look at me sexually. Yeah, but you're not a woman, right? You don't know what it's like for a woman who, I mean, it's complicated because, of course, I think women want to be seen as sexually desirable, but they also don't want to be ogled by gross men. So, like, that really is painful to them. And there is something about that. And yes, the incels are misperceiving that because, yeah, like, maybe for a woman, having bad sex is like literally like eating excrement. And it's like, yeah, you could eat it, and maybe there are even some nutrients in it, but the very thought is emetic. Now, with that, so like, I think that's important. And that is actually why I worried about those incel chat rooms. Like, I thought, you know, this is important to study, of course, but also I worry about this ideology because I think when you get bitter, aggrieved people together, they reinforce each other's failure and bitterness, and that can be dangerous. But it is true also, as you say, like, it's not just men saying this. There is this gap, and one of the problems here is, and I mean, this is a more systemic problem, but it's almost as if, you know, with this rising inequality and then these super efficient mating markets, right, that we didn't used to have. Like, you used to kind of just have your neighborhood or your community or whatever. Now you can get on Tinder and see, oh shit, there are like thousands of guys like this now. So this hyper-efficient mating market coupled with rising inequality actually just ends up making a few men way more desirable and then a lot of men not desirable. And women are like, you know what, if it's between being childless or having a kid with that guy who's kind of a loser, I'll be childless. So what is,
yeah,
here's
absolutely.
The difficult question, of course, and I read your work and, you know, you forwarded some advice for incels, but isn't there here like this more systemic problem that we have to think about? I mean, what is like ultimately creating the incel phenomenon, and then also this disconnect between what a lot of women say they want and what they get?
Yeah, absolutely. And David Buss, my supervisor, wrote an essay about this in 2016. He really saw the writing on the wall. He described it as the mating crisis among educated women. And we're currently working on an academic paper together just on the mating crisis more generally, because it kind of affects lots of different people in different ways, not just educated women. But it is an unintended consequence of predictable by evolutionary mm-hmm. psychology, of course. But it is an unintended consequence of women beginning to outpace men socioeconomically and not be dependent on them. And you could say that that is a net good that is worth the mating crisis, maybe. But it does come with these crises. Women's responses to this mating crisis and this lack of eligible men out there is very, very interesting to me, especially in like the modern technological era. So last week I read the article about women increasingly mm-hmm. freezing their eggs. Maybe women will go with artificial wombs and just stay together. Maybe they'll adopt on their own. But also, women's sexuality is a lot more flexible and fluid than male sexuality. Mm-hmm. Men tend to be straight or gay and kind of stay that way. Once they kind of develop, you become a teenager, and you tend to not really shift around too much. Women's is very, very fluid and flexible, and kind of maybe one response to the mating crisis for women might be to be more open to, if there's not enough eligible men out there, maybe they'll switch their sexuality and be more bisexual or something. You've heard of all these concepts like gay till graduation. That's a new one I had heard, that women sometimes are gay until graduation because colleges are a very kind of dangerous environment with lots of drinking, and the men are kind of dangerous, so they mm-hmm. want to avoid that. But they do want to get married to a man eventually. I'd never heard that one before, but it speaks to this idea of this flexible fluidity to women's sexuality. So that could be one interesting response to the mating crisis. Men's response might be to increasingly retreat into virtual worlds, surrogate, artificially intelligent mm-hmm. girlfriends. I actually had a podcast clip with my friend Chris Williamson talking about this round-the-corner dystopian view of artificially intelligent girlfriends. And one kind of positive topspin we put on it towards the end was that it might actually be a training ground for men to practice flirting and mating relevant skills. You know, the mating market is the only game in town that you actually don't get to practice for it before you're in it. You're thrown into it in a baptism of fire, and you know, you've got to learn by trial and error, anxiety inducing, yes. going up, talking to a girl, figuring out, and it's complex and it's hard, and a lot of people get hurt with the clumsy come on attempts that men make along the way. So one positive white pill might be to say the artificially intelligent AI girlfriend could be a training ground, because there's no status afforded to the man who has a lot of artificially intelligent sex. It hasn't happened yet that the guys are turning up to the bar saying, "Hey, wait until you see my amazing robot girlfriend." It just doesn't come with the status. Right. So the sex robots, and it might scratch the sexual itch, but it won't scratch the status itch. And for men, being sexually selected by a flesh and blood woman is actually really, really important for status. It's all tied up together. So that's an optimistic view of our dystopian
future.
So
this is fascinating, because my wife has both of these theses. So one about women just turning into like facultative lesbians, as it were. And then the other about the sex robots. Now let's go to the facultative lesbianism just for a second, because I find it's fascinating. Gay do you graduate? Is it echoing on your side?
Yeah, gay till graduation.
Is it echoing on your side? Okay, good. Nope. Okay, it's nope. It's clean on this side too. We'll just edit that out. No problem. Yeah. So gay until you graduate. It tells you how different women are from men, because if I were in a group of men who were like, "Let's just be gay until we graduate," I'd be like, "There's something wrong going on here."
Yeah.
The sex robots is just terrifying to me. So the point you made about the status, I think that is an important point. It's one that my wife makes. Oh, well, you won't get status for doing it. But at some point, you won't even give a shit, because you won't need other people to give you status. You'll be like completely cocooned in a world of your own making. And that, to me, that's like, this may be unfair to libertarians, but I find that as like the optimistic libertarian scenario. It's kind of like the UBI. Well, we'll solve this problem. We'll just give people the UBI. Oh, well, people just get artificial girlfriends, and then like there won't be that problem. What happens when, because I think it's important to note that women's chief value, and I don't mean this in like an anti-feminist or derogatory sense, I mean this in an evolutionary sense, their chief value to a civilization has always been that they have a womb, and that's this really important, scarce resource. So what I've been worrying about is, well, you get artificial wombs and you get AI girlfriends, you pretty much obliterate the value of femininity and womanhood. Am I getting ahead of us, or is this something like that legitimately we should worry about?
Yeah, you touch on a very important point, and it kind of speaks to why I'm often surprised at female resistance to artificial wombs, because, you know, it's such an emancipatory achievement as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, infant mortality and mothers dying in childbirth and pregnancy has been such a massive problem for humans throughout our ancestral environment. We've made huge progress in the last 50 years even on that front, but the ultimate progress would be to completely liberate women from it entirely. But there's a massive resistance there, and this kind of biophilia, this love of nature. But it might be more, there's an essential part of femininity there that we don't want to push against. But to play devil's advocate, you could also make the point that the whole game is up in the air in terms of our biological roles throughout our ancestral history. So men's role was resources and protection. Not really the case anymore. Women are able to compete for resources just as much, especially if they're not hamstrung by having to give birth. That would really yes. free them up to compete on that front. So, you know, the whole monopoly board is tipped over in terms of our reproductive roles, kind of limiting the social status we take on. So it's a, yeah, you could say that men are as obsolete as women in
which
the
is
future.
Quite true, which is horrifying to me, I might add, but my listeners will probably tire of my dire predictions about AI.
And actually, your own supervisor, Bo, yes. Roy Baumeister, he was way ahead of the curve on this. He wrote the book,
yes,
What Are Men Good For? And, you know, he was really seeing the writing
absolutely.
On the wall there.
So let me... I have four great questions we like to ask to conclude an interview, but let me just make this point and you can add, ignore, whatever to it before asking those. So it's interesting because I think you could make both a conservative and a progressive argument here, right? So the progressive argument would be what you said. Well, everything is in the air. Roles are being flipped over. Ultimately, we should attempt to just transcend our this is a strong way of putting it, but our sort of slavery to biology. That would be the ideal. And just to reach a higher level where, I don't know, maybe like abstract intelligence is what matters. And we're finally liberated from the, you know, vicissitudes and exigencies of nature. On the other hand, the conservative...
Darwin called them the hostile forces of
nature. Exactly.
So our own biology could be the hostile
forces. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, very good point. Absolutely. Like, yeah, we've almost seen ourselves, our own, like, we're compelled to excrete waste, and how degrading for an animal. Let's transcend that. On the other hand, I think the conservative case would be, no. We don't know what's going to happen if we start going down that path. What we actually need to do is to understand that feminism in some sense was a mistake, because at least second wave feminism, because it didn't take biological differences seriously. And it actually led to narratives that promoted, that led to less psychological flourishing for men, but also for women who are actually pursuing careers that don't make them as happy as, you know, I don't know, maybe having children and being an important member of a family would make them. Those are two extremes, obviously. I'm just trying to sympathize with both sides and see like which arguments you could make. If you have any thoughts on that, cool. And then we'll go to the questions.
Yeah, I mean, that's the million dollar kind of question is, where do we go from here? And I tend to think that you don't typically go back. Yes. And if you view progress, especially in recent decades of women's economic liberation and kind of flourishing, that has led to a massive net good for capitalism. And that's kind of the driving force culturally now. So I don't think that's going to grind to a halt. But yeah, it is grappling with what this these attempts to overcome the hostile forces of nature is the interesting piece. I think, you know, to be classically centrist, there is a balance of a pendulum to kind of swing back towards the middle, that it will become more, people will be kind of become awakened to this idea that, okay, a lot of women are maybe leaving it too late to have children. And, you know, it's a very novel thing that women are able to kill it in the workplace. That kind of shine might wear off after another couple of decades of, it's not long that they've got used to this. So for a woman now to make the decision, oh yeah, feminism, you know, all those rights you got me. Yeah, don't really need them. I think I'm going to go back to live how you did in the 50s.
Right.
That's kind of a difficult ask for a young woman to do now. But who knows, 30 or 40 years into the future, it could be very different.
Yeah, that seems like, I mean, I move back and forth myself. Sometimes I become a reactionary, and sometimes I'm like, forget it. Let's just transcend all of it. So I think the judicious centrist position perhaps is the more appealing one. Okay, so
another one final thing to talk about on that is our evolved mating psychology is very sensitive to cultural norms and cues of what you afford status to, and what you afford status to is pretty arbitrary on some fronts. You know, it's generally to do with competency and kind of prestige. But, you know, you could imagine a world where you afford status to the greatest stay-at-home dad and that he becomes attractive in the mating market. But I don't know how fast we're getting there. I think there's an asymmetry between how much men don't mind partnering up with women who are earning a lot, but women really don't like partnering up with men who aren't earning a lot. So it's a massive asymmetry there. But yeah, we can create culture to be
I think that's a really important point, because that's a very common misunderstanding. And I guess you made this point a long time ago of evolutionary psychology, though, which is evolutionary psychologists do not think humans are determined to be the same in all social... Quite the contrary. They respond to incentives, including the incentives of status and prestige, right? Which are, as you said, obviously they're not arbitrary, but they're more flexible, right, than perhaps like brain tissue, although maybe in the future we can alter brain tissue. But yeah, so we could alter what we give status and prestige to, and humans definitely respond to that. So what is, and this is a broad question, but who do you think is the best proponent of a worldview that is against your worldview? So perhaps the most readable and eloquent critic of evolutionary psychology or of your work on incels, whatever that happens to be.
I think we're actually more aligned in the way we see the world now, but traditionally I maybe would have said...
Now, if you want to hear our guests' answers to the bonus questions that we ask, then you need to become a paid supporter. And you can do that over on our Substack page for just $6.99 a month or $69.99 a year. I promise you it's well worth it. Supporters also get early access to the podcast and to our special filmed conversations, which go up over on the main channel somewhere over there or down below. The link is always down below. And of course, if you liked this, then you will love our online magazine. You can check that out by clicking the link down below. And if you are so inclined, you can find the links to our Twitter and TikTok. Thank you for watching, and we'll see you in the next one.
I always hear at weddings that I go to, a common bridesmaid speech is, "Congratulations to my sister, Jenny. You're now sitting beside the man who is most likely to kill you."
And it's like,
but it's kind of true. And I couldn't believe it. He obviously was on holiday or something. He was in his skiing gear talking to me. He was like, "Well, after 3 hours, but I got to go. There's not many weeks left of the fresh powder." And I was like, wow, this is, you know, a legend to me. And he took time to talk to an absolute unknown.